Hi, everybody. This is Gila Glassberg. Welcome to another episode of Get Into It with Gila. Today's interview was so moving and so inspiring. I interviewed somebody named Jenna Zalka, and I won't give away the episode in the intro, but Jenna has been through so many things in her life, and she is here to tell the tale with a lot of strength and faith. And I just thought today would be a good day to share this. That I've been really trying to start my podcasts with Israel on our minds, because of course it's on all of our minds, and just to have the hostages in our tefillos and everybody, all the soldiers in our tefillos and everybody in Israel in our tefillos and all the Jews around the world in our tefillos. And just wanted to share one quick thought before the episode is that today is December 25th that I'm doing this intro. And today is actually my oldest child's birthday, December 25th. She is 11 and she's my only girl. And then I have three boys, and I've been listening and watching Rachel Polan Goldberg talking about her son Hirsch every single day. Today is day 79 that they've been held hostage. And I watch her, and two podcast episodes just came out this Matzei Shabbos on Saturday night, one on the Meaningful People podcast and one on Yaakov Langer's Inspiration for the Nation podcast. And I listened to both of them, and I've been watching her on Instagram, and she's so strong and powerful. And she keeps talking about how if she falls apart, then she won't be able to save Hirsch. And I don't know, this, it just kind of reminded me of my, not that we're in the same boat in any way, and not that we have, not that I know of so many similarities, just when she keeps talking about Hirsch, like changing her identity into mother. And today happens to be my daughter's birthday when I became a mother, and I just think about her every single day and about Hirsch every day. And I thought it would be an important thing just to bring up his name to daven for. His name is Hirsch Ben Paralchana. And if you have time, or if you're davening for anything specific, if you could keep his name in your tefillos today and every day, and hopefully he'll come home today, and all of the hostages will come home today now, and let's just keep davening for them and their well-being, and even the hostages that were released, just for their continual refuah shleima, that they should have a refuah shleima of their body and their soul. And this episode with Jenna talks a lot about her trials and tribulations and coming through it. And I will say a trigger warning about eating disorders. If you are in an active eating disorder, I don't think this is the right episode to listen to. It's not really that graphic. It's just that if you are still struggling in recovery, this might be a bit triggering. But I happen to have, of course, find Jenna's story so meaningful and powerful and strong and so much aligned with what I teach people and intuitive eating, and that you can change, and you can change your belief systems and even things that are so ingrained in you that cause so many life altering changes for you. You can create positive change. So listen closely. It's a bit long, and as you'll hear, Jenna's daughter joined us. She was our co-host, and although it's funny that she's in the episode, I think that, well, as you're listening, you'll see how appropriate it is that she was actually there in the episode, healthy and strong, at age three. So, enjoy the episode. As always, please leave a rating and a review. It really, really, really helps. I would love if you would support the podcast. You could always, subscribe to the podcast. You could send money via Zelle, via my business number, 570-878-3642. And even if you don't want to support the podcast with financially, you could always just rate the podcast, review the podcast, and share the podcast. And that really, really, really helps. And I really think that 2023 is turning into 2024. I really think that the world has become more open to intuitive eating and making positive changes, whether it's with ourselves, whether it's with our children in schools. And I am so excited that there has been a shift. And I think that one of the main ways that we do that is to spread the intuitive eating information out there. So if you are looking to make peace with food, you could reach out to me at gilaglassberg18@gmail.com and schedule an appointment. You could also go to my website, gilaglassberg.com, and sign up for a free 20-minute consultation. And without further ado, here's the episode. Hi, everyone, and welcome to my podcast, Get Into It with Gila. I know you're going to love the content here because you will gain inspiration, powerful tools and insights, and valuable knowledge. If you want more of this, please visit my website at www.gilaglassberg.com or visit me on Instagram at Gila Glassberg. I'm Gila Glassberg, a registered dietitian and intuitive eating counselor. I have come to realize by counseling many, many women that this work is much deeper and greater than food and body image. It's the bigger picture challenges we face of love, belonging, acceptance, what our true values and goals are, noticing them, addressing them, and gaining skills to move forward. If you have been struggling with what your life's purpose is, or you just feel stuck in general and don't know what's holding you back, this podcast will enlighten and inspire you to take action and move forward. This podcast is about other women in the 21st century who feel that losing weight will fix all their problems or somehow meet their unmet needs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Get Into It with Gila. I'm Gila Glassberg, your host, registered dietitian and intuitive eating counselor. And today I have on Jenna Zalka. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank God. Sorry, I have a co-host today.
No problem. We love having co-hosts. What's your you want to share your co-host name?
What's your name? Samara. This is Samara.
Oh, Samara. She's so cute. Okay, so let's just start with introducing yourself. Where do you live? What do you do?
Okay, so my name is Jenna. I live in West Hempstead. I've been teaching Limudei Kodesh for like Judaic studies for about 10 years now. I'm currently at North Shore Hebrew Academy High School. And about 6-7 years ago, I don't remember when, but I went back to school for social work also. So now I also have a very, you know, like small, chill private practice at night where I see children and teenagers.
Amazing. So let's start with your first career, which is still your career of teaching. Did you know you always wanted to be a teacher?
So not at all. I actually never had any intention of becoming a teacher. When I was a junior in high school, I was like one of these really big questioners. Like I questioned everything my Judaic studies teachers asked, like about God. And just like, I had a lot of questions that I felt uncomfortable asking. Basically, long story short, I met this guy at a bus stop and he like, you know, tried to convince me that Christianity was the way to go. And he like showed me, you know, quotes from the Torah to try and prove his point. And that started my personal journey to like understand religion and to really feel closer to God and believe that I'm doing the right thing. And basically after going on that journey, I decided to become a high school Judaic studies teacher so that if I ever had students who were in my position where like they felt just that they didn't believe what their teachers were saying, they had questions that they didn't feel comfortable asking, things like that, I wanted them to know that they had someone safe they could come to. So that's kind of when I decided to become a teacher. I think I must have been in Israel for the year at that point.
Okay, that was a plot twist that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, sorry.
No problem. So you were at a bus stop where, in Israel?
No, I went to school in Queens. I went to Central, and I was ditching Navi class for free iced coffee day at Dunkin' Donuts. And this guy approached me and two friends at this bus stop. And he's like, "You're Jewish, aren't you?" And like, I happen to like strangers. So I was talking to him. I think my friends were a little weirded out, but yeah,
Yeah, I totally would have done the same thing, especially when I was in 11th grade, you know? That's really interesting. Cause I actually, just what's coming to mind for me is I had this teacher in high school who was actually an amazing teacher, and she's like doing great in her career now. But I actually remember like she was so excited about God, and she would like talk about God all the time. And I remember asking her after class, but like, how do you actually know that like Hashem's real? Because like Christians also think their God's real. And then she just was like, it's just one of those things that you have to like believe. And I was like, okay, that was like a really hard question to ask, and like that didn't really help me, and I was really young, you know, 11th, 12th grade. But that's so cool that you actually like
decided to like learn Judaic studies to teach it to kids that like are struggling, because it's a real struggle when you're that type of kid. It's like you just feel really lost.
Yeah. And the truth is, I always make sure to tell that story to new classes in the first half of the year, because I want the kids to know that, like, if you do feel lost and if you do have questions, like, you don't have to be embarrassed to come talk to me. You don't have to be embarrassed to ask me. Been there, done that, totally open about it. And I do. Every year I get kids who just ask. And I'm like, I'm happy that they do. Like, it's important. Like, I don't want them to feel embarrassed. So
do you feel stumped sometimes and you have to like get back to them, or you feel like you have the answers?
So I actually, yeah, I never answer them on the spot, ever. Because I feel like for every kid, the question is coming from a different place. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where like the social work piece of my life comes into it. Some kids, it's not that they don't believe, and it's not that, you know, they have all these questions about God, but it's more coming from an emotional standpoint of anger, you know, if they've had difficult things happen in their lives and stuff like that. So I always, you know, I always kind of get back to them or talk to them later on about it, specifically because I want to think for myself, like, where is this child coming from and what's pushing this question? Now, I've had students, I actually have one who just came home from Israel for the year, like last year. And, you know, I do have some students who legitimately have these questions, and those students I'll sit down with, we'll talk sources, we'll talk like theology, philosophy. But I would say that, like, you know, I'm not going to do that with every student. Like, right. It really depends on the nature of where the questions are coming from.
For sure. Sometimes it's just like a kid or even an adult is just like, I'm just hurt and I just want you to hear my hurt and not answer my question, you know?
Exactly. Sometimes they're not ready. So,
right.
Yeah.
So when you were in seminary, you feel like you like got the answers or not so much? Or...
So I feel like I really got the answers before seminary. Like in my senior year of high school, I did a lot of learning and just a lot of reading. I was very mature. And so at that point, I went to seminary kind of knowing that this is where I stood and this is what I believed in. But when I was in seminary, I realized I was like, you know what? I think I want to become a teacher so that no one has to go through what I went through. Like I went through 9th, 10th and half of 11th grade, totally just like confused and not talking about it.
Right.
So my year in Israel was when I just decided to do this professionally also.
Okay. So you did know for a long time that you wanted to be a teacher.
Yeah.
Actually, like, yeah, teaching is such a different skill than counseling. It's like so different.
Yeah. Very different. Very different.
Okay. So then what brought you to social work? Like, how did that happen?
Okay. So this is actually also interesting story. My first year of teaching ever, I had a student who had an eating disorder. And I had a lot of students with a lot of different, you know, stuff, I guess you could say, over the years. But it was really my experience helping that one student that encouraged me to go into counseling, because I became that safe place for her at school. And just in general, I would visit her in the hospital. There were all these different elements to that student's story. I don't want to go so detailed reality, but that really inspired me in a sense. And then, you know, after, I would say, I think it was after 3 years of teaching, I realized that, you know, this is something that I actually have a knack for, and that if I trained, like, I could really help people. And I could do both. I could teach during the day, do counseling at night, or become a school counselor. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with it. I just knew that I wanted training, because I really felt that if I honed in on like this skill set, then I could really help people. And I love helping people. Like, I've always wanted to help people. So yeah, that was it. I got married a little bit later. I needed something to do with my free time. So at 25, I went back to school.
Yes, I was going to ask you that, if you like were married yet or if you had kids yet, like it's a really big undertaking to go back to school. Like, you already had your degree in teaching.
Yeah. I had already had my teaching degree. But it's funny, me and my husband, we met when we were 16, actually, but I broke up with him when he was Shana Bet, whatever, not important. But I ended up being single at that point until I was 27. So when I went back to school, like, I was just you know, I was looking for other things to like fill my time, make me feel, you know, productive when a lot of my friends were already married and having babies.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up not finishing when we got married, because a little less than a year into our marriage, I got sick. That's a whole separate story. But I ended up finishing later on when our daughter turned two. I went back to school for my last two classes
and my year
of field work. And that was really hard and really crazy. But it wasn't possible to finish beforehand because I was just going through too much health-wise.
Wow. So. That's a lot of things. Yeah. So you were teaching, let's say, for like 4 or 5 years, and then you're like, okay, I really like teaching, and I really like what's, you know, enlightening the students that are struggling, like with the same thing that you were struggling with. And then I guess like the next step is that like you kind of were like their counselor in a way, but you didn't have the skills or the training. So you were like, okay, I'm not married yet, I don't have kids yet, and now I have more time, so I could get another degree, and that would also help me as a teacher. That would, you know, counseling would help me teach, teaching would help me counsel, right? Like that type of thing.
Exactly. That was my thinking. That was my thought process.
And eating disorders in general, was that something that you were interested in?
So actually it was the one thing that I said I would never do because I had an eating disorder. I struggled with an eating disorder during my teenage years and during my early 20s. So I always said, there's no way I'm ever going to treat eating disorders. There's no way I'm going to help anyone with an eating disorder. Like, it's going to trigger me. And it's so funny because as time went on, it's actually something I became interested in because I guess as time passed and I became more removed from the issues that I had, you know, as a teenager and as someone in my early 20s, as I became more removed from it, like, it didn't trigger me anymore. And it's something that I really fully understand. I feel like on a different level because I went through it. So now it's actually something that I'm considering getting like continuing education in and, you know, being trained by IDEP or some other organizations just because,
Well, do you mind sharing a little bit more about your eating disorder? Like how, like what maybe like not like too much, but like what you think maybe triggered it and how you got better? Cause that's like a big one, you know, like how people actually heal from an eating disorder.
Yeah. So, it definitely started in high school, 9th, 10th grade. I would say there were a few different factors. Socially, I was having a very, very hard time. All my friends were in the same track and I was placed in a different track. So I was kind of like socially isolated at school. I grew up in a small community in Queens with only like 8 girls my age, and they were all in class together except for me. Like, that was very hard for me. You know, all my friends went to sleepaway camp. I didn't because I was homesick. Like, I was the homesick. So I always like felt somewhat isolated. Around the same time, my dad lost his job. I had an older sister who, you know, had stopped being religious. That was like, even though I had my own questions, that was hard for me.
Right. That was probably maybe what, you know, got you questioning, you know?
Right. Before. Exactly. And also like she had lost a lot of weight around that time. And like, in the end of the day, my parents were never pushy with us about weight, but weight was like a topic of conversation. Like, you know, my dad was always on and off diets. Like I have memories of being in like 4th grade and like knowing that I had a doctor's appointment that day. So like, oh, I have to not eat so much lunch. Like I had these like built in things growing up that kind of, I really don't even know where they came from. But it was kind of just, I hit 10th grade and it was really the perfect storm. Like, so many things were going on at once. And I think it was really my desire for some sort of like control and also just to be able, like, my body was changing. I went through puberty later. So it was my way of controlling how my body was turning out.
So you, like you said, in 4th grade, you remember that? You have that memory of like not eating because you had to go to the doctor like that? Yeah. Like, that's very young. That's like 9 or 10.
Yeah. No, I was a kid. And right. I think there was also an emphasis placed on body stuff because I was always very athletic.
Mm-hmm.
So I did karate. I was a black belt in karate. Like, in a sense, as much as it wasn't body image stuff, there was an emphasis placed on like
your body and your body. Right.
Right. Exactly.
It's interesting because, first of all, that's really sad. And she's so cute. That's really sad because that's so young. But also, I think it's important for whoever's listening, clients or just people who listen, that, you know, I tell this to people a lot, that like, even if your parents never explicitly said, like, I want you to lose weight, or like, being skinny is really important. For those who are not watching and they're just listening, we have a co-host here. She's so cute.
Can you go upstairs for 2 minutes?
Yeah. Okay. So you, I'm just going back to, okay, fourth grade. Yeah. So this is what I tell, you know, people in general, that like, it didn't have to be that a parent explicitly says, like, I want you to lose weight, I want you to be this body size. It's just a message that we pick up, whether it's at home or just our friends or just society, whatever it is, it's like a very strong message. Even like you're saying, you were 9 or 10, that you had that, not just thought, behavior, you figured out a behavior,
right?
You know?
And I really think, like, you know, I don't blame my family and I don't blame my dad, but like, there was a lot of yo-yo dieting. He was being told, you need to lose weight, you're not healthy, you know, things like that. And I think, you know, when you're a kid and you hear these things just being talked about, it impacts you, you know?
Of course.
It's not something that you necessarily need to be impacted by. Like, you hear what your parents are talking about. So it just,
I'm not a therapist, but I just have picked up some therapeutic tools along the way. So I always tell clients to think about, like, just for a moment, like, think about, like, what is something that you know that your mother, like, found really important without her ever telling you, you know? So, like, if you think about it, you know, whether it was like chesed or like the way that she looked or her job, like, you could, you know, like, even if you have to think about it for a second, you know, right? So, like, we know what our parents' value systems are, whether they tell us or not. They're very, very strongly ingrained in us. So it's the same thing with weight and dieting. If we get this, and again, it's not pointing fingers, and it doesn't even have to necessarily be like your, you know, nuclear family, but it very often is like those belief systems around you that you kind of like pick up by osmosis. And it usually is
society. Like, we're all society enough that the messages get we translate those messages and we internalize them.
Right. And I think it's important, like, for moms to hear this and for daughters to hear this, because, like, on the one hand, it's like, why did I pick this up if it's not that important to me? Okay. So we, like, learned it a lot as kids. And as a parent, it's like, you could tell yourself from today till tomorrow, you could be on a diet and not tell anyone, but your kids will know. They will know, you know?
Exactly.
Another thing I wanted to say, I've probably said this before on the podcast, is do you read Glennon Doyle? She wrote the book Untamed.
Yes, she's fantastic. Okay.
So I don't agree with everything that she says, but she specifically, I quote this a lot, she developed like bulimia when I think she was like 10 or 11, very young. And she explains that because like her identity was so much wrapped into the way that she looks, because she was very skinny, she was very pretty. When she would go out with her mom, people would be like, your daughter, she's so beautiful, she's so skinny, she's so whatever. So for her, it was like, I better hold on to this identity, which is so interesting to think about, because like, I think about this in terms of like people who are like exceptionally pretty, right? Or exceptionally good looking, like men or women, right? So very often they get comments like, wow, you're so pretty or so whatever. So they internalize, it's really important to be beautiful. And then they get afraid of losing that identity, even if they don't want that identity. I mean, everybody wants that identity on some level, but when you get like older and you start questioning your value system, you're like, people only like me because I'm pretty. That's weird. You know, like, I'm so much more than that, you know?
Right. No, it's great. Yeah, it's true. It's very true. We hold an identity. Like, when I think about who I was as a kid until I was a teenager, really until I started high school, I was the black belt. Like, I was the athlete.
Right.
And, you know, then I became a teenager. I didn't have as much time for it because I was in school till 5 o'clock every day or 5:30, whatever it was. And, you know, you have to like, figure out, who am I now? Like,
right,
what am I
right.
now? Yeah.
Like you were saying before, that like you were a black belt. So like there was just such a strong emphasis on your body. There was like a lot of like, you're strong, you're, you know, fit, whatever it is. So it's like, even if you think like, when you're so young, you just like pick up an identity. But as you get older and you're like, especially because you were a questioner, you weren't one of those teenagers that was like, la-di-da, obviously, right? You carried the world on your shoulders. You're like that type of teenager. So it's like, you obviously are going to start thinking, even if it's like you're not even so connected to what you're thinking, but you're like, something's not working. And I think that's a lot of children who develop eating disorders are those like very intuitive kids, right? They pick up on people's pain and they can't tolerate it. And like they numb on hunger, they numb on binging, right? It's so interesting because people don't realize that the eating disorder itself is the coping mechanism, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So when you were in 10th grade, you developed an eating disorder?
Yes. It really went, I would say, unnoticed until I was a senior, at which point, I guess, physically, like it was more noticeable when people would look at me, and I fainted on a school Shabbat home. So my parents got a phone call about it. And that's really when I started getting treated for it. That's really when, you know, the treatment started. I would say I did outpatient treatment for a bunch of years. Really at that point, I had no interest in actually getting better. I was 17 years old. My senior year, my year in Israel, I really, all I cared about was maintaining my weight and just maintaining my behaviors enough that I could just go on with my life. That was really what I cared about. I didn't care about the future. Mm-hmm. I didn't care about, you know, long-term recovery.
Right.
It was really only once I hit my second year in Stern, and I actually had to leave to go away to treatment, that I started realizing, you know, this is really going to mess me up. Mm-hmm. Like I need to really get better, because if I'm going to have to graduate a year late from college because of this, and if this is going to interrupt my whole life, like I paid for a semester of college and now I can't even finish it, you know, like that's when it really started to hit me that, that I had to get this under control. And that's, I think, when I started trying more.
Right.
I cared.
That's why it's so hard to treat young, you know, teenagers, young adults, because it's like, hard. It's even as an adult now, like when I see people with eating disorders, it's like, you want to shake them and be like, hello, right? Like, but you also have to remember, like, I also struggled. I didn't have an eating disorder, but I struggled with disordered eating. And I just remember like thinking about my food all day. And like, even if somebody would be like, you have to eat more, I wouldn't be able to. So like, it's like, on the one hand, you're like, come on, like you got to get better. And on the other hand, it's like, they're not there. They're not 100% there to think I have to get better, or they're too young to understand the future, right? Teenagers don't really understand the future. They're not supposed to. So it's like, it's very sad to watch, but it's typical. That's typical, you know?
Right. And I even have memories, like I was dating my husband at the time, but he had no idea what was going on. And I remember, I think one of my teachers in Israel for the year in seminary, like she said to me, she's like, you think he's going to want to marry you if like you have a serious issue? And I remember thinking to myself, like, yeah, why wouldn't he?
Right.
Like what's the big deal?
Right.
You know, not thinking that, yeah, this would impact him also. And like, it's probably a very good thing that I broke up with him before I went away for treatment, because there's no way he would have wanted or been able to handle that as a 20-year-old boy, 21-year-old.
Right. Right. It's really a lot. So when you said you weren't treated till 12th grade, did you know that something was wrong in 10th and 11th, or you were in denial?
So I knew something was wrong, and I had one friend, really just one friend, that picked up on it, and we would talk about it. But I think that I viewed it at the time more as disordered eating than an eating disorder. I didn't realize I had a full-fledged eating disorder. I just thought that like, I had some unhealthy behaviors around food, and that like, whatever it is, what it is. But I think my friend was more intuitive than I was. And she was like always pushing me to go see the school counselor and things like that. But I never would until 12th grade. I was very resistant.
How did people around you not pick up on it? Were you just really good at hiding it because you didn't want anyone to take away your behaviors? I mean, that's common too.
Yeah, I also think at the beginning, my behaviors were a little bit more secretive. Like my eating disorder, I went in and out of really all the different types of eating disorders there are. So I started with more of the secretive behaviors. And then I think once I hit 12th grade, it had morphed a little bit into more of like an anorexia, where, you know, I was like, it was very publicly acknowledged.
Noticeable.
It was just more noticeable.
Right.
which I think now as an adult, I look at that and I'm like, that is absolutely terrible. Like, that is so sad that, like, mm-hmm. you know, like I was suffering so much those 2 years prior
mm-hmm.
because it was more like of secretive behaviors and it wasn't as noticeable in my body. Like, I really thought I had no problem because right. it's not noticeable. So like what difference?
That, and that is also perpetuated by the medical system of like, you know, like kids, like doctors often don't talk to the parents about their weight unless they're overweight, quote unquote, in the BMI, which is like really sad. And also it's just sad that I understand why people think this, but they think that like anorexia has a look, bulimia has a look, binge eating disorder has a look. It doesn't have a look. I know like logically you might think someone who's underweight has anorexia, but it's not true. Like somebody could be quote unquote overweight and still struggle with anorexia. Like, so I think it is weight shifting away from weight and more on behaviors and the intensity, but it definitely wasn't when I was a teenager. It was like, right. you're only sick if you're emaciated, you know?
Exactly. And even like, you know, my first time in treatment when I was 19 or 20 years old, my first time away, you know, at that point, I think I was, you know, underweight and whatever. But at another point that I went to treatment also earlier on, I was struggling with anorexia, but I was actually overweight because mm-hmm. my metabolism had changed so much. Mm-hmm. And I remember actually being treated differently during those two experiences in treatment and like really being like horrified. Like mm-hmm. I was struggling so much more the time that I went that I was overweight, but now I've heard that treatment has really moved away from this perspective. Yeah. But right. at the time, it was like the people who were underweight were the ones that, you know, they were stricter with, that got more attention. It was like a very weird dynamic.
Yeah. That's a really interesting perspective to share. Like, it's really true. Like, there's so much weight stigma, even in eating disorder treatment centers, that like, you know, like they want you to gain weight, but not too much. I think it is getting better. I have heard that it's getting better, but it's still, you know, like the eating disorder, you know, revolution is like slowly trickling in, you know, it's more up and coming, but there's still so much more work to go, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So you said that in 12th grade, you fainted at a Shabbaton. Did you feel like I don't want to get too like detailed, but did you feel like a sense of accomplishment or did you feel scared at that time? Like how sick did you feel in terms of like your thoughts?
I don't remember it so well, but I do remember thinking to myself, like, I was actually more embarrassed than anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had gone so long hiding it and mm-hmm. just being like very private.
Mm-hmm.
That I think I was embarrassed that like it was noticeable now. Like now it was right. noticeable. Like to me, right. that was like embarrassing. And also that meant that I was going to be forced to get help. And I knew mm-hmm. that. And I really did not want help. I had no interest in help.
I mean, you were struggling like in secret for 2 years, which is like really, really intense.
It was horrible, but at the same time, I was comfortable in it. And I right. knew that help meant that I would be uncomfortable.
And it was helping you in yeah. whatever way.
I didn't want to break my patterns, even though right, I was struggling right. and I was suffering. It was like, to me, that was more comfortable than needing to go to therapy and change the way I was eating and, you know, change mm-hmm. my thought process. Like, to me, living the way I was more comfortable than that.
I don't know, but you might have also been one of those kids that didn't want to like disrupt your parents. Like for some kids, they want to disrupt their parents. They need the attention so badly. And for some kids, they're like, I know I'm sick, but you know, my parents are paying for therapy for this child or this or that. And it's like, it's so sad that they get some sort of message that like their needs and their pain don't matter, you know?
Yeah, I'm happy you brought that up. That was a huge part of it. I was terrified for my parents to find out. I mean, my parents are incredible. They're wonderful. They're so, so supportive. They always have been. But I was always like distanced from them in a sense emotionally. I never really shared with them what was going on internally for me, just in general. I wasn't that type of kid. So mm-hmm. I didn't want them knowing. Like right. I didn't want them knowing that I was struggling. I just wanted to like be independent. And also I was kind of the easy sibling, you know, I'm the youngest of three. And I would definitely say I was until that point, the easy sibling. And right. I didn't want that to change.
That was like, your identity.
I wanted to be the easy one.
Right. you didn't want to show that you like had more needs or like that you needed extra help or hand holding. You're like, I got this. Like I could do anything, you know?
Exactly. Like I always had good grades. They never had to intervene. Like it was all like, I just did what I was supposed to do.
Right.
So I remember being very nervous about that.
That's also a very heavy burden for a kid to carry. Like I better not drop the ball because whatever, I have this identity of being the good one. So it's like, it comes out in so many different ways. And for so many people, it's that like, you know, that anorexia of like not eating to like, you know, like something's got to give, you know, like something, like I have to have something that I could just be mine, you know?
Yeah. And it's actually also so funny now looking back on it. Like that's how I viewed myself at the time. But in reality, you know, I've spoken to my parents since, like, I was by no means the easy kid. Like I went from sleepaway camp 2 times because I was too homesick. I had such bad anxiety. Like I wasn't the easy kid, but I think it's how I viewed myself just because my sister was rebellious and, you know, my brother was always like the perfect one, but he had some tough friends, you know? So like, I always just thought that like, I was the easy one. My parents are like, no, you were never the easy one. I'm like, oh, okay.
If I would have known, you know,
like using identity on ourselves, like totally not accurate.
Right. I mean, again, like you were a child, and also like we know how not eating enough affects our brain, you know, like that's another really big component of anorexia is that like the calorically deprived brain is not a healthy brain. So it just, I always tell this to parents, it spirals so quickly because you have to get refed before anything. If you don't have adequate calories, you can't really get better. And that's where a lot of the resistance comes from, is that you're not mentally well if you don't have adequate calories. So you have to be mentally well to be motivated to get better. You know, it's like very hard.
Yeah. And it's, how do you get the calories in someone if they're not motivated? And it becomes a very long process, because by the time your brain catches up with your body, it really, like your brain, I mean, you could tell from more of a nutritional standpoint, but I seem to remember that my brain did not catch up to my body for a long time. Meaning my body was at a healthy weight and my body was at like a healthy point for really a few years until I stopped, or until my thoughts calmed down. I didn't have the eating disorder urges anymore or the thoughts anymore. Like it really took a very long time for my brain to catch up.
It's really hard. It's really, really, really hard. Eating disorders are so complex, but they're also really fascinating, you know, like how people don't understand like what, how like people hold on to them because they're helping them in so many ways. So, also, I want to ask you about your teenage years. Was it when you did have this eating disorder that nobody knew about, was there something else motivating you? Like, did you just like being very skinny? Did you like the compliments, or did it have nothing to do with attention? Cause like people didn't even know.
Yeah. I think at the beginning it didn't have anything to do with attention because people didn't know. I think that once I got the compliments my senior year, and once, you know, it started becoming more visible, that did become a part of it. But it initially had nothing to do with it, because initially it wasn't noticed.
It wasn't about your weight. It was just about being in control.
Right. Like it was about my weight to me, but it wasn't about my weight to other people. I mean, I do remember, and she's still my best friend to this day, but I remember, you know, one time we were having a conversation and I was angry at her and I was telling her how frustrating it was that all the other girls, you know, were hanging out, but leaving me out because I wasn't in their classes anymore. And I remember like, she said to me something like, well, maybe if you lost weight, like so-and-so, you know, you fit in better. And I remember like thinking at the time that had such a deep impact on me. But I was never like trying to lose weight so that I could fit in with them. It was more internal for me.
Right. It's really hard. Like it's, somebody could say one thing, of course, not even like trying to be mean. And it just, because we're so entrenched in diet culture and like, you know, the thin ideal, it's like everybody wants to be thin. Like that's, of course, it's like, you want to be rich, just like you want to be thin. So it's like really like, I guess for like professionals like us, it's like really just trying to explain what it is and break it down, because it's like, just, you see how devastating, people just don't understand how devastating it is to, you know, have a child with an eating disorder, or themselves trying to get better from an eating disorder. Like you said, it took so long to change your thoughts and then change your behaviors. It's really, really hard.
Yeah.
But they also don't exist in a vacuum. Like you said, you had terrible anxiety. So, but also people don't know that.
Right. Yeah. Like meaning, you know, Could have seen it coming.
Right. And also, like, the eating disorder helps cope with anxiety or the OCD or whatever. So people don't realize that. So when you went to treatment, you said that you weren't ready to heal. So how did you actually, they couldn't force you, or did they?
Yeah. So, okay. So, you know, senior year and my year in Israel, it was all about that year in Israel. I wanted to be in Israel for the year. And I knew that if, you know, my eating disorder was out of control, I was going to be sent home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, first it was about going to Israel for the year. Then it was about staying in Israel for the year. There was a point where they almost did send me home and I totally turned things around because that was what motivated me. At first, it was all these external factors. And then my first time in residential treatment, I was 20 years old. It was my second year of college. And I remember being with these women who were in their 40s and their 50s, and like their children were visiting them. And it really hit me hard. I was like, I don't want my children growing up with a sick mother. Like, I'm not interested in that.
Right.
And that was what really motivated me. I mean, I'm not going to say that I was a one-time in treatment person and then I was fine, meaning right. Like I did have to go back two more times to other places and whatever. But I think that was when I actually started having internal motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And then what really changed things for me, for some reason, it really helped me, was DBT. I switched mm-hmm. to a DBT therapist, you know, after college, and I just found it to be the most helpful form of therapy in the world for me. Maybe because it was so structured and I was such like a structured person that I just really found it helpful. But that was the big change for me.
So that's so interesting. In the other treatment centers, or like, I guess outside of residential, I'm sure you were seeing a therapist. What modality of therapy were they using?
So I think it was really just talk therapy. Like she was
like CBT.
CBT. Right. She was an eating disorder trained therapist. She was phenomenal, really phenomenal. But I think I also got to the point where like it wasn't healthy for me to see her anymore because I wasn't looking for progress with her. And like right. She knew that. So I was starting to become a little bit like manipulative and like right. I would get angry at her. Like it was just, I was so sick at that point that like she wasn't going to be able to help me. And she knew that. And
mm-hmm.
So she told me and I had to find someone else. I was devastated, but like yeah. it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
That's a good practitioner, yeah. You know? So you started doing DBT and that just gave you skills that you were lacking.
Exactly. Exactly. DBT skills, honestly.
I you want to explain what they are a little bit? Because for those who don't know.
Yeah. So DBT has four modules, basically like four categories or areas of skills. And basically the skills, you utilize the skills to help get you through difficult times. So there's mindfulness, which is like the basis for everything. It's kind of just being in the moment. And they, you know, they have practice exercises and all this stuff, but then they have skills in different areas. So there's distress tolerance, which is basically what do you do when you feel like you're in crisis? Like you feel like you can't breathe, you can't do this anymore, you just don't know what to do with yourself. Like, what do you step back and do? So they have like skills for that. They have interpersonal relationships, which this was never something I really struggled with so much, but they have skills how to interact with other people. DBT was originally designed for individuals with borderline personality disorder who do struggle a lot with interpersonal relationships. That's why that's one of the modules. It was never much of an issue for me, but I did DBT, so I did it.
I'm sure it helped anyways.
Yeah, it was actually, I found it helpful because for me, I had so much anxiety just communicating mm-hmm. that it took away a lot of the anxiety because I was able to like structure my thoughts when I spoke to people and things like that. And then the last module is, I think I'm doing them out of order actually, but emotional regulation, which is basically how long-term can we behave in a skillful way so that our emotions are more like this instead of like total ups and
right.
downs,
right?
Like crazy mood swings. So yeah, it's basically DBT is you have one individual session once a week, and then you have You participate in a skills group once a week where you learn these skills. It takes 6 months to complete the entire course, quote unquote. I actually found it so helpful, though. I stayed where I was having my therapy, and I did it 4 times. Wow. And then at one point when I went to residential treatment, because I wasn't doing well with my eating disorder, I actually went to a residential treatment center that was focused in DBT, because I knew that that worked for me and I knew that it would help me. So
it's such a good feeling when you find like the modality that works for you. And also, like, just for people listening, like, there's so many different modalities of therapy, and some work for someone great and some work for someone not as well. And also, depending on what's going on in your life, like, there's, you know, there's different modalities that will help here versus here, you know, like, I've found that in my own like journey.
Sorry, 1 second. Samara, what do you need to open? Bring it down to me. Okay.
Yeah, so just finding the right therapeutic model and modality is like definitely makes a big difference. So, and then you said like you know, there's different schools of thoughts with eating disorders. Like some say like you can heal, and some say you always have it. It's like it could just be dormant. So you feel like you're in full recovery. So how, what, like, do you want to walk us through like a little bit like how you feel like you actually recovered, or like what it was like for you to like not have those intense thoughts anymore?
Yeah, I actually, it's so funny because I didn't even realize that I had recovered, or that like my recovery was going so well, I guess you can say, until actually after I got married even. I must have been like 28 years old, and I got pregnant with our first child. And I remember I wasn't concerned about what I was eating. I like didn't have any concerns about weight gain in pregnancy. And I was just like, what? Like, wow. How am I not worried about this? And I think that's when I realized that like I had really made progress. And even my husband, like he had known about my history at that point, but he would always say like, I just seemed to eat intuitively. Like I didn't, it was definitely a process, but mm-hmm. I didn't realize how well I was doing until I actually got pregnant. And I was like, you know, I remember like 5 years before I had been thinking, oh, if I get pregnant, this is going to be so difficult. I'm going to have mm-hmm. to eat this, and I'm going to have to follow a meal plan, and I'm going to have to, and like, here I was just doing what I wanted. And
right.
Not being concerned and not stressing over it. So that was kind of when I realized how much progress I had actually made. And then even when my daughter was born, and I wasn't like struggling with body image, like I gained quite a bit of weight in that pregnancy. And like, I was just like, okay, it will come off when it comes off. Like I wasn't stressed about it. I wasn't upset. And like, you know, was it annoying that my clothing didn't fit me? It was, and it was hard, but like, I was okay with it. Like I was able to manage it. So
What happened? Sorry.
No problem.
What
happened? So what I was going to say is that I think obviously everybody has to do what works for
them. Down here. Sorry.
No problem. I feel like it does a little bit of a disservice for people to think that they never heal, because then they feel like they're never healed. But if you do have that belief system that you can heal, and that like, that's a really good example of like, you know, for so many people getting pregnant and nursing and their bodies changing is like a huge trigger, even if they've never had an eating disorder. So I feel like your story is an example of like, you know, they say like, you can't, like you have to fall really low to get like really high, you know, that like saying,
right,
like,
exactly,
like you really got, even though like, just for people who are listening who are / have struggled with eating disorders or kids are struggling, like when you were in it, you probably felt like you would never, ever, ever heal. But because you did finally get that internal motivation, which is like a great internal motivation of like seeing older people who are still struggling, that's like a huge thing for people. Like, I tell this to clients all the time, not eating disorder clients, but just disordered eating and intuitive eating. It's like, you've been dieting for 20 years, right? Now you're 40. So are you going to, is your mother still dieting at 60? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, that will be you. Like, there's no way it won't be you if you don't change something, you know?
Right. And I remember when I was in it, I was thinking to myself, there's no way people fully recover. Like I really there's no way people fully recover. And I think it was only when I was really a few years removed from it and just living my life for a few years,
mm-hmm.
I realized like, wow, you actually can recover. Like I think I had to not think about it so much.
Right, like, right.
Think about and not be so focused on fully recovering.
Right, right.
I'm so focused on fully recovering and I was just living my life. It just came. Like
Well, it's probably like all the hard work that you did and the fact that you were able to not think about it. Like you said, that was really good, like self-awareness that you didn't go into the eating disorder profession at the time because you needed, your brain just needed a break from it. Like I know for myself also, like sometimes I'm out, I like to talk about this all the time. Like sometimes I'm like at a party and someone's like, oh, you're a dietitian, you do eating disorders, intuitive eating. And they're like, what do you think about this? I'm like, I really don't want to talk about that now. Even though it's like my passion and I could always talk about it. Like sometimes I just can't, like I just have to go and eat and not be like, am I hungry? Am I? It's like, it's too much for a brain, you know?
Yeah, you need a break. I remember it's funny because I was introduced to intuitive eating like very early in the whole intuitive eating world. Like I remember I saw Christy Harrison as my nutritionist, like when I was struggling with an eating disorder. Like,
Really?
Yeah, like she wasn't even like big yet. And then she ended up coming out with books and a podcast. Like I was introduced to it very early on and there wasn't much like knowledge surrounding it and people weren't so into it. So I remember to like a different nutritionist that I had seen and she's like, what is this nonsense? I'm like oh, I thought it was great. And she's like, oh, but like it was great.
I love when I like read articles and dietitians are like, it's intuitive eating is good but you can't like fully believe it because blah blah blah. I'm like, ay, 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 what did you just say? You know, like obviously everyone has to do what works for them, but it's like people just don't know what it is. And then they like make all these like, you know, statements about it and they don't know what they're talking about just because they don't know what it is. And it's a little hard to explain on one foot. So people don't really understand what it is. And then they just dismiss it. And it's like sad because it could be so life changing, you know?
Yeah, no, I found it to be extremely helpful. And it's literally how I run my life now.
Right.
We just pause for 1 second.
So after you fully healed and intuitive eating was it a big part of your healing, would you say, or you were still like on the fence about it?
So no, so it definitely at some point it became a huge part of my healing. Like I actually stopped seeing any dietitians because I felt that they weren't supportive of it. Like the, you know, now the eating disorder world is much more supportive of intuitive eating and stuff like that. But I would say like 5-6 years ago, you know, the majority of dietitians were not. So stopping to see a dietitian. I stopped, I stopped seeing a therapist like every week. And at that point, I just started incorporating things on my own. And that's really when like, I just, you know, sometimes taking things into your own hands when you're ready is really what makes the change. And I think at that point, after, you know, 8 years of formal treatment, I was just ready. Like I was ready to be done.
Wow, that is a long time. And I was going to say the same thing, that sometimes when you take it into your own hands and you're strong enough, the outcome is really good. And sometimes people do that when they're not strong enough and they don't realize and it's not good. So it's like, you know, it's such a nuanced thing of knowing when you're ready, you know?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I did it like with approval. Like I did
really,
like, you know, my parents knew, like I had spoken to my therapist about it. It wasn't like, it wasn't just like a random decision that I made on my own. Like I made.
I actually like learned this pretty recently, like in my own practice and from other therapists, that one would think that like the healthiest thing to do is to stay in therapy if you can, if you could afford it, if it's, you know, you have the time, why not stay in therapy for forever? But what someone pointed out to me is that people who do that, who don't really need therapy, rely too much on their therapist, which is so interesting, such an interesting thought. Like I see it also in my practice, like sometimes you have to let the client go, even though you don't want to, like you love the client and you're working well together, but they're too dependent on your advice or your accountability. They need to be in the world.
That's it. And it was actually my DBT therapist. My DBT therapist was making Aliyah and he pointed it out to me. He said, like, you got to just move on. Like, stop therapy. And he was right. He was right.
Right. So. And then you became a therapist and then like you just ready to transition. Yeah. So you mentioned that during your first pregnancy, you got sick. Do you want to share about that?
Yeah, so that was a very difficult time. Basically, my first pregnancy was COVID. I got pregnant like a month before COVID. And basically, everyone expects some morning sickness, but I actually got very lucky and I didn't have much morning sickness. What ended up happening was during my second trimester, that's when I ended up with morning sickness, and I ended up with such severe migraines that I couldn't sit up. I was throwing up constantly. Like, I needed to be on at-home IV nutrition. Like, I was really, really deteriorating very, very quickly. And because of COVID, there was like a lot of push-offs, like at the doctor's offices. No one was really seeing patients. It was March 2020. Like, it
Wow.
wasn't, it was March, April 2020. So, long story short, after multiple visits to the ER and multiple times the ER saying, normally we'd admit you, but because of COVID and you're pregnant, we're not. We don't know what COVID does to pregnant people.
My gosh, that's so scary.
Really horrible. They sent me to a neurologist. Now, I thought, nothing's wrong with me because I had been to a neurologist numerous times for migraines and they'd done numerous MRIs of my brain and nothing had ever been wrong with me. But that time, they sent me for an MRI of my brain. And when I went, Hashem had a hand in this, the MRI machine, it took an image that was too low of my brain. Like, it was supposed to do only my brain, and it ended up getting a portion of my spinal cord. And I came home from the MRI and, I got a phone call from the doctor that was basically, he basically said, "We think we see something in your spinal cord. You need to come back in 2 days for a full MRI of your entire spinal cord."
Wow.
So my husband took me back. By that point, I wasn't walking. I wasn't,
I
like, I really wasn't well. And the nurses at the MRI place had to wheel me, like, and change me into the gown. Like, I really wasn't doing well. But I was teaching on Zoom because everything was on Zoom. So why not, Really saved me. But I ended up, it was a Friday, and I got home from the MRI. And as soon as I got home, my phone rang, and it was the neurologist. And he said, "This is the biggest tumor I have ever seen inside someone's spinal cord. You need to see a doctor, and you need to see a doctor right now. Like, you need to see a specialist today." So what ended up happening was he gave me a bunch of names. Such hashgacha, one of them was a student's father. Called the office and they said there are no appointments for 3 weeks. I used the, "Oh, but I'm so and so's teacher, please tell him," like, whatever. So they put me on hold. Came back, they said, he says, "Come into the office right now, he'll meet you there."
Wow.
I went into the office and we were basically told that had we waited 3 or 4 weeks, I would have been fully paralyzed.
Oh my God.
And nothing more they could do for me, nothing more they could do for the baby. Like, that would
Wow.
have been it. And what ended up happening was I had to undergo at 19 weeks pregnant emergency spinal cord surgery to remove the tumor, which, when you undergo spinal cord surgery, especially one that's inside your spinal cord, not the outside of your spine, but the inside, you basically have to relearn to use the body parts that are underneath that part of your surgery. So for me, the surgery was in my neck, which meant that I had to learn how to sit up again. I had to learn how to walk again, learn how to, like, use my arms again. All of this while I was 5 months pregnant, like 6 months pregnant, 7 months pregnant.
After your surgery, how long was the recovery? Like, were you out for like a few weeks, or you were awake a few hours later and up?
So the surgery itself was 8 hours. I was in the hospital for 8 days. Normal people go to a rehab center for about 6 weeks, a month to 6 weeks afterwards. But because it was COVID and I was pregnant, we ended up moving in with my parents. I lived on a hospital bed in their living room
Oh my God.
for like 6 weeks until I could make it upstairs,
Oh
with
yeah, so hard.
up having private PTs, OTs, etc., come to the house, because I think it was like nursing homes, rehab centers, they were just filled with COVID. Everyone was
right.
Really, like, it wasn't an option to go. But that definitely impeded my recovery because I wasn't getting
enough support.
Right, exactly, enough support. So it took me about 6 weeks to walk again, to take like a step, really. Like, I just couldn't, you know, do anything. And then I was walking with a walker. And then I was walking with a cane. I was walking with a walker until I remember I hit like 34 weeks pregnant. And I'm like, I could walk without a walker now. It was like crazy. And then I was really walking with a cane until I had my baby.
Oh my God.
And then I had to relearn to do everything all over again after my baby was born, because once my baby was born, now I had to learn how to live with the nerve damage and the, you know, the deficits that the spinal cord tumor had given me, like long-term, lifelong deficits.
Was your baby affected at all?
So they actually, when I went into the hospital for the surgery, I was approached many times. They wanted us to abort or to terminate, like, you know, at 19 weeks.
I'm happy your daughter was in this episode so everybody could see how adorable she is. Yeah. And that didn't happen.
Right. But me and my husband, I was in the hospital myself because of COVID, but we had spoken about it beforehand. And we said, we are not. Like, we will not terminate. You know, whatever happens, happens. But they were like telling us also, because of some of the medications, you know, well, I've never been on them. They're like, you know, she's going to be oxygen deprived. She's going to have issues with her brain. She's totally fine.
Right. Wow.
So she's really a miracle. They were like preparing us for the worst. Like, they said, like, yeah, we can't promise you she'll breathe outside the womb because we don't know if her lungs will have developed properly. She's fine. Like, thank God, she's more than fine. She's very bright and very precocious.
How was the birth? Did you have to have a C-section? Was it like any different?
I had a scheduled C-section, and I'm not allowed to have an epidural or a spinal. So it was under general anesthesia. So I had to go to sleep.
Which is, by the way, I had two C-sections, and I wish I could have been put out. I know everyone like scoffs when I say that, but I'm so afraid of blood and pain and all that stuff. I'm like, are you done? Like, I can't, it's so hard to be awake for that.
Now I'm 36 weeks pregnant, and I have like a C-section scheduled in like a few weeks, whatever. And I keep saying to them, like, can you just put me out again? And they're like, no, you're eligible for a spinal this time, possibly.
Wow.
No, just put me out again. Like, I'm not interested. I don't want to be awake for this.
It's really, yeah.
Yeah. So whatever. But
it's funny because some people say, like, no, they think that's horrible. They want to be awake. They want to feel like, you know, even if it's a C-section, they want to be awake for the birth, you know, which I get.
I wanted that last time. Last time with my daughter, I was very upset. I wanted to be awake. This time, our life is a little complicated. This baby has a very rare heart condition, and he's basically going to be whisked from the operating room. Like, I'm not even going to get to see him. So I kind of like, I'm just not interested. I'm like, if you're just going to take him anyway, put me to sleep. Why do I have to be awake for that?
Right.
He's not interested.
Right.
But that's kind of why I don't want to be awake this time. But with my daughter, I desperately wanted to be awake. But they also, like, they didn't know what was going to be with her either. So I remember like going to sleep, and then I woke up and I didn't hear crying.
Right.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, she's not crying. Something went wrong. And they're like, no, she's been alive for 20 minutes. You've been sleeping. Like, she cried already. I'm like, oh, like, I like didn't realize.
Right. How would you? You were put out and then you were woken up. Like, how would you realize?
Expect. Yeah. So she, thank God, she's like exceeded all expectations. But that also, like, when something like that happens to you, and then you end up like, the left side of my body does not work as well as the right side of my body.
I don't even know how you're recounting this story. It must be like, I don't know, some of your brain is like shut off when you tell it. Cause I am like, I'm traumatized just from hearing it. I don't know how you.
I do all the details. That's why I'm not traumatized, because I'm like leaving out half the stuff.
Right.
But the truth is, it was really traumatic, and it took me like a long time. I actually had been out of therapy for a very long time before that happened. And as soon as it happened, like I found a therapist again. I was like, I can't do this. Like it was a really right. big trauma. And it also, it's like, you know, like I kind of felt at the time, I remember thinking like, I worked so hard through my late teens and my 20s to have a healthy relationship with my body.
Right.
Now my body will never work like an average person's body. Like now I will always have left side deficits and I will always have chronic pain on the left side of my body. And I remember like feeling such like hurt and anger at like the universe. Like, how could you do this to me? Like, meaning like
right.
I worked so hard for a good relationship with my body and now my body doesn't work. Like,
right.
It was like, it was a lot. And it took me, I mean, I'm still not full. Like, I can't say I don't have my ups and downs. I get very upset about it.
Right.
But it took me a long time to cope with that as well, just because it was such a shock. Like, it's not something you expect at 29 years old. I was 29 when it happened. Like
you never expect it, you know? Right.
Right.
Wow. There are so many like places I could go, but like, first of all, that's crazy. Second of all, I'm so glad you're okay. And they found like the tumor in your spinal cord and that you were able to be seen by the doctor that day. And like your baby's healthy and you're healthy. Like you have, like you said, deficits, but it's like really a miracle, but it's also really hard. That's like really, really hard.
Yeah, it's exhausting. And it's funny, I find it like similar to the eating disorder in a sense, like suffering from the eating disorder those first 2 years when nobody knew. I kind of sometimes I talk to my husband about this. I feel like I'm in a similar situation now because it's not noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I have a disability. I live with a disability.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, people know, everyone knows. But it's not noticeable that like someone sees me on the street, they'd be like, oh, you know, like,
right.
So it's like, it's almost learning how to live with something again. That's like, so not noticed, but like completely changes your life.
Right.
Like completely changes the way you function.
Right. Right. On the one hand, I don't know, but on the one hand, it's like, when you have a disability that nobody notices, it's like you're incognito. Like you could kind of like, you know, nobody's like pitying you and whatever. But then on the other hand, you kind of like sometimes need the pity because you're like, I can't stand on this line. Like I'm not faking, you know?
Exactly. Or like, I really want to park in a handicapped spot. But like,
right.
I mean, it's my own nonsense. I refuse to get the thing, you know?
Right,
Like,
right.
I also feel like if I did, people would look at me and judge me. Like, why is she parking? Like she looks totally healthy.
Right.
It's like one of these funny, you know,
yeah,
internal struggles.
Did anything change in terms of your body image, like for the positive, like realizing how, you know, taking the focus off of the way your body looks and more on the way that it functions or no?
So I'll tell you something very interesting with the spinal cord tumor and with like basically having like a disability afterwards and stuff like that. My whole body changed. And I lost a ton of weight, not on purpose, but because my body's working so hard. And I say all the time, I would rather weigh X amount more and be healthy than like be quote unquote thin and live like this.
Right.
Like it made me appreciate health much
yeah.
more. And like that, I really don't care how my body looks per se. Like I could dress to however my body is, meaning like if I gain weight, I could dress to that. If I lose weight, I could dress to that. But in the end of the day, like it made me realize how much I just have to, or we have to like appreciate just our health. And that like, you know, we could work with whatever our body, whatever our natural body size is, like we could work with that. Like people look incredible. People make themselves look amazing and dress well at all different sizes. But like to think that I spent so much time focused on like a size when like there's just so much more to your body. Like that's really what hit me and what changed.
Wow. It's really beautiful. Part of intuitive eating is the like respecting your body, right? And that, like I always say, it's like taking the focus off the way your body looks. Of course, it's important to take care of the way that you look and feel good about the way that you look, but like we're so focused on it. It's like such a big part of our focus, and like our bodies are so much more than just the way that they look, you know? And you really experience that in your body.
Right.
On so many levels.
Yeah.
Wow, this has been like a crazy, amazing ride. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. And I think it's going to help so many people, like so many different aspects of the story. And thank you for being like open, honest, vulnerable. Is there anything you want to leave the listeners with before we end?
Too many things. Like I wouldn't be able to come up with one thing. One thing I say though is that like if you do struggle with food and you do struggle with your body, have compassion for yourself. Like don't blame yourself. Don't blame those around you. Like give yourself space to struggle and give yourself space to grow, because you know it really is possible to get better, and you're not going to see that progress in a period of 6 months.
Like, right.
It's going to take time, and that's okay. So just give yourself that time and that space.
That's like something that like is really hard to hear in it. Like if you would have heard that when you were struggling, it might have not like resonated, but just to hear it from you on the other side of so many things, it might really impact somebody. So thank you so much for sharing that. And thank you for coming on. And everything should go smoothly with this pregnancy, and you should feel good, and you should experience only good things in your life.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you all so much for being here on my podcast, Get Into It with Gila. If you'd like to learn more about what I do and what intuitive eating is, please visit my website at www.gilaglassberg.com or follow me on Instagram at Gila Glassberg. Thank you so much. Have a great day.